Centre for Public Christianity. You're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. And because it's Christmas, we've got the whole Life and Faith crew together for our last episode of 2017. In the studio today, Natasha Moore.
Season's greetings.
And Justin Toe.
Ho, ho, ho from Toe, Toe, Toe.
And the founding father of CPX, John Dixon.
Felicem Nativitatis Diem.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Only you, John.
Well, my notes said, say it in Latin or Greek. The Greek is Kale Christiano.
Explain.
Well, the first one, Felicem Nativitatis Diem, means like happy birth, the nativity birth day. So it's just like happy birthday, but everyone knows it's Jesus' birthday. And the other one is Kale Christiano, it just means happy Jesus' birth.
You're one of a kind, John.
Later on, we'll be getting down to this sick beat.
That was Geoffrey Liu, an Australia's Got Talent alumnus and friend of the show. He's going to share his incredible gift of beatboxing with us.
But first, a story about the potential hardships and heartaches of the festive season from one of our listeners. This is Beck Oates with Celebrating Christmas.
Like when you've spent 3 months researching and preparing the perfect Christmas lunch, something on trend with rustic table ornaments made from old jars, a salad with kale, some socially responsible bonbons, colour-coordinated crockery and perfectly placed jugs filled with Christmas cheer, and Auntie Vera arrives with her three-day-old potato salad that gives everyone the squirts, presented in her crystal bowl from 1969, and plonks it with pride in the middle of the table, sending your mini wooden placeholders flying into your bowl of raw vegan chocolate fruit balls, and you want to punch her in the face. Or perhaps you yell at the kids in the car on the way to lunch because you're tense about seeing your sister who never ceases to offend you. You arrive covered in a thick shell of bitter resentment. She opens the door, gives you the once-over, spins you around and slaps you on the back saying, ha, look at you, you even have back cleavage. And you want to punch her in the face. Or perhaps you're sitting on the couch, watching the kids open their presents, and you look over at your spouse with sorrow and regret, staggered by the enormous crater of sadness and hurt that's formed between you, and a tear slips down your face as you mourn the loss of what was and steel yourself for the prospect of what will be, and you want to punch him in the face. Or perhaps you wake on Christmas morning with a pit of grief and loss threatening to destroy you. You swing your legs over the bed and gaze at the empty pillow of your loved one who is no more, whose memory brings joy and unbearable pain. And you wonder how you'll survive the day, if you want to survive the day. And you want to punch God in the face. How do you celebrate Christmas when you're in pain, when you've suffered injustice and you're hurting? Well, here's an idea. Serve. Wait, don't punch me in the face. I'm going to try, just for one day, to put aside my anger, fear, resentment, grief and hurt, and serve. Boring, maybe. Hard, definitely. But I reckon that serving's a good way to celebrate Christmas. Wash Auntie Vera's crystal bowl and ask her to bring it again next year. Pay our sisters a genuine compliment. Squeeze the hand of our spouse. Surrender our pain to God. Just for one day. Never know, it may be good. We might keep on doing it. No promises, though, because the face-punching option is really quite appealing.
That was Beck Oates.
Well, just like Auntie Vera and her stale potato salad, there are many ways that family Christmas gatherings can go absolutely wrong. And I think even more so now, right? Because we seem to live in this era of the echo chamber where we're so used to hearing our own opinions bounce back at us. But maybe not at Christmas time, because you can't choose your family, right? And subsequently, you can't choose the divergent politics of your family members. So what are we going to do after 2017, after our year of absolutely fractious political debate? Is your table going to become an honorary taping of Q&A?
Yeah, it feels like we say this every year now, that we talk about how fractious 2017 was.
It's a good word, isn't it?
How fractious 2016 was. You know, the polarisation just gets stronger and stronger. I read a really interesting book this year called The Righteous Mind by a guy called Jonathan Haidt. The subtitle is Why Good People Disagree on Politics and Religion. And I actually read it because John said to me, this is the most important book of the last 5 years. And so I was like, okay, maybe this will give me some insight into why we disagree so much and how we can do it better.
Yeah, I mean, Haidt is he's an evolutionary social psychologist at New York University. And his analysis of lots and lots of studies is that we tend to make up our mind based on instinctive reptilian aspects of our subconscious, that we have pretty much made up our mind on a lot of ethical, religious issues, and then we call on the rider of the elephant. So the elephant is our instinct and the rider is our rationality. And we call on the rider to justify our decisions. Mm-hmm. And really the only difference between super high IQ people and average people is that the super high IQ people are better at justifying their own beliefs to themselves and others. There's actually no difference in the ability to arrive at the truth, which is fascinating.
Wow. Or to change their mind.
Or to change their mind. And in the end, the book says this is such a powerful thing going on in the human person that there's only one way out, and that is humility. Huh. That is a kind of intellectual realization that I could well be wrong. I could well be driven by my emotions, my experiences, my prejudices here, and just covering it with my rationality. And I immediately thought of all these proverbs, you know, in the Old Testament proverbs, that basically say that that kind of lowliness is the path to wisdom, you know, that the arrogant have blocked their own way to knowledge.
And he's very big on, I mean, listening to one another and actually asking questions and trying to figure out where the other person is coming from. So he talks about how people on the left and the right, you know, both care about fairness, but people on the left tend to think of fairness as being associated with equality. People on the right tend to think of fairness as being associated with proportionality. People get what they deserve. And so therefore we kind of argue at cross purposes a lot, not really realizing what the other person's commitments are. So I feel as though that kind of, let's try and figure out what each other really mean. It's probably a good tip for Christmas lunch if we do find ourselves in these political debates.
Yeah, so we should stop every time a debate begins at Christmas and say, so let me just see that I've got your perspective. Would it be right to say that you think, and see if you can articulate it?
Yeah, and pass the gravy. I was especially moved by the last couple of examples in Beck's story and the fact that for many people, the truth is Christmas is not so bright and merry. There are many people for whom this time of year is actually really difficult, maybe even unbearable. A couple of years ago, you might remember, I wrote a story at Christmas, but I interviewed a whole lot of people who were going through really tough times, including two people who were living in Syria, which is still bad, but was particularly dreadful then. They were Christian believers talking about what Christmas meant for them then. And it was amazing to me to hear them articulate, A, how terrible their situation was, and there's a real desperation about that, but also a very real kind of sense of what the Christmas story offered them. There's an incredible hope that they talked about, and that it was sort of sustaining them. I found that amazing, actually.
Others actually find the happiness of Christmas to be the problem. I mean, you know, you can feel really alone. You can be feasting with friends and then just remember that there are many people who have nothing. The happiness that can be a little bit tragic and sort of raise that sense of tragedy. I mean, quoting the Buddha is perhaps a little bit awkward at Christmas, but the Buddha said, I've always agreed with him, that sometimes it's in the happiest moments of our lives that the sadness pierces through, because you know that that happiness will pass. Mm. Now, he was quite a depressive about it, in that he said that every single happiness is a sadness precisely because it's ephemeral, that it's going to pass. And so it is a sadness. I can't quite go that far with him, but I think there are many people who find this season deeply worrying and lonely precisely because you're meant to be happy, happy, happy.
Mm, it does really irk me at the forced joviality of so much of how we do Christmas. Like if we go over the top with decorations and Santa's lap, all that sort of stuff, it just feels like we're grinning so hard that our faces are going to break.
Mm.
And what's that covering up? I don't know.
Sometimes churches do this too. I had an experience recently where I turned up at a church service and I was not in any positive frame of mind. I was glad to be there, but I walked in and it was immediately upbeat and everyone was meant to be happy and probably clapping their hands and feeling joyful, and I just wasn't feeling it. And it didn't feel right to try to force that, and eventually I just kind of sat down and looked miserable.
And of course, like, church has so much to give the person who's miserable and not in that frame of mind.
Should do, yeah.
I mean, I think this is true for the Christmas story as well, that we like the Christmas card version when we're happy. We like the sentimental, picturesque story. But actually, the story in the Bible of Jesus's coming is very different from that.
Well, it's brutal, isn't it? The story opens with Emperor Augustus flexing his muscles, demanding a census of the world, which is all about him exercising his power, you know, to work out how many subjects he has, therefore how much taxation he can get. And we're told that in that context, this little couple has made their way from Nazareth to Bethlehem, probably not on a donkey. So that's 7 or 8 days solid walking.
And she's very pregnant.
She's pregnant. And they get to Bethlehem, just a little village, probably nothing like the beautiful Christmas cards. And we're told that there was no room for them. And it's unclear whether that means a room in the house or you know, the room that they're expecting wasn't there. The language is a little bit vague. But then it says when the baby was born, they laid the baby in a manger, which either means the animal feeding area of the house or the actual animal feeding trough. Either way, it's not pretty. And so and this word manger is repeated 3 times in the Luke version of the story to make the point that this is very low. And manger, of course, is only a word we use at Christmas. And you could be forgiven for thinking it's a special bed for the Son of God, right? But it's just an animal feeding area. And the point of the story is God has come into this sort of this world of brutality where Herod wants to kill people, where Augustus wants to rule people. And God has come right down at the lowest point in a little village precisely to get alongside the hurt, the brokenness, the mess, to reverse it, enters into the lowest point in order to start bringing everything back up.
And this is the substance of the song that Mary sings, right? And when she's reflecting on all this, if I could just read, she says, "He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty." It's incredible, isn't it? Like it's a political statement, and it's in such stark contrast to the way that we get all nostalgic about this story, the way that we sort of think that it's for kids. It's not actually for grown-ups as well, but it's actually for all of us. You know, it's a story that can actually cope with the horrors of our world, because it also looks at the horror and the darkness of the human heart.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity.
What you're about to hear is something pretty remarkable. There are no instruments used in this next musical number. In fact, every sound is coming from the mouth of one person, Jeffrey Liu. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us on Life and Faith.
Thank you, Natasha.
Can you tell us, how did you get started beatboxing?
So I started beatboxing when I first came to Australia around 12 years ago when I came to Australia for high school study. Mm-hmm. And I went to a local church called Parkside Church, and that's where I met my mentor, you can say, Joel Turner, who is the 2005 World Beatbox Champion. So I was actually helping him to carry some of the sound equipment at a shopping center. So before that, I didn't have any idea what beatbox is. So that is the first time I heard beatboxing. And when I heard all the crazy sound, and I was like, I've got to learn this.
It was that compelling.
Yes. So I've this never heard that noise or the sound in my life. And I haven't heard anyone from China at that time who did beatboxing. So I said, I'm going to be the first one in China. So that time, that's what I thought. I'm going to be the first one in China. But now it's got so popular and a lot of people can do it.
So do you remember the first time you tried to make those sounds? The very first time?
Yes, I did try. So after that, I went home and started looking up on YouTube. And I have actually learned the sound from one of the British beatbox guru, whose name is Tight. And he's also, an Anglican pastor. So I learned from him from the very, very basic sound, like the three basic noise, the kick drum and the hi-hat. And the snare, like, and so that's where I first started.
But you've gone quite a lot beyond that, and you're adding new sounds all the time. What's your favourite?
My favourite one, because since I'm living in Australia now and I'm working here, I really love my Australian didgeridoo sound. So that is something that reminds me that I learned this from Australia, and I really love this land and the people and the culture here. And the other one, probably the Chinese instrument, since I'm from China.
Uh-huh. That is so cool.
Thank you.
So some people may actually remember you from Australia's Got Talent.
Oh, yeah.
You made it through to the semifinals a few years back. What was that experience like?
That was a very, very gift from God for me, because at that time I was in year three at uni, and I said to myself, because at the time, I don't know where I'm going to be, like in China or in Australia. I said, I want to do something that will be memorable for my life. So I want to go to a TV talent show. The original goal for me is to appear on the first round. And surprisingly, with my friend's help, we form a group called Jack in the Box. And Kyle actually really love our show, and we have Danny Manel and Brian McFadden. They all voted yes, so that is a bonus to me at that time. I didn't expect it at all to move to the semi-final, but I was really, really happy and really feel blessed.
So do you want to be famous for your beatboxing?
At that time, you know, it's interesting, the original goal for me to learn beatboxing was not actually get famous at all. To me, at that time I was at high school, I said to myself, if I in the future don't have a job, at least I can, you know, perform, make money on the street. So that is my bottom line. So as long as I can use that as a talent to entertain people and to really make a living. And I didn't expect at all that I get this opportunity to get to the national TV. And later on, I've got a lot of invitation to perform for commercial events, like the Microsoft. They invited me for their annual convention. Even the Chinese company, like the Southern China Airline, they invite me for their 20th anniversary. So all that opened from the wish to make a living on the street. But actually, you know, always God gave me more than I need and more than I expected. So that I feel really blessed.
Jeffrey, you've actually prepared a little something for our show.
Yes, but I need your help with it.
Okay, we're up for it. This is The First Christmas with Jeffrey Liu and the CPX crew.
Some say the first Christmas was a silent night.
Some say that the first Christmas was a comfortable and quiet one for Joseph, Mary, and baby Jesus.
Some even say that as the cattle were lowing,
and baby Jesus awakes.
He didn't cry.
Some say it was a silent night.
But I'm not so sure.
Around the manger where Jesus lay, there may have been cattle lowing, yes.
Donkeys braying.
Sheep bleating.
Meh.
And camels spitting.
And then, in a field not too far away, shepherds were keeping watch over their flock by night when a host of angels appeared before them.
So the shepherds went in search of baby Jesus, also singing.
Gloria, me, 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 me.
Then there were the wise men making their way to the baby Jesus, bearing gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
And let's not forget the little drummer boy who followed the wise men to baby Jesus. He had no gifts fit for a king, but he had his drum.
So some say the first Christmas was a silent night, but I say maybe it was not so silent.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with, well, a bunch of us from CPX.
This is our last episode of the year, but we've had plenty of amazing conversations during the year, which you can listen to on our website, publicchristianity.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just type in Life and Faith and watch the magic.
Our most downloaded episode of 2017 is a conversation with an actor who didn't judge anyone, except for Christians, but then became one herself.
You know, I'd been trained in a liberal arts education. I had come from the LGBT community. I had come from a group of people that had felt so rejected by the church. And I personally felt so rejected by the church, having never had anything to do with them. Had never really experienced oppression like some people had, but it felt institutionalized to me. I felt like the feelings that I had, whatever I was coming up against, I blamed the church quite automatically. I used to walk around and say, I don't judge anyone except for Christians.
We spoke with a man who was told by his doctor that he had only 2 years to live. He outlived this prognosis, and he continues to live with motor neurone disease, but also with hope.
I don't know what I'm going to be like when I can't roll over in bed, can't scratch my nose, can't shower myself, or, you know, all of those things. You become so dependent on other people, and I'm not looking forward to that. But actual death itself, for me, has lost its sting. It's lost its power over my life because I truly believe in heaven and eternity. And so for death, for me, is just, you know, entering into another realm of existence and life, which is far better than I think what we could ever experience here.
Changing gears, we had an astrophysicist, Luke Barnes, in the studio to talk science, rationality, and the wonders of the night sky. And of course, whether the stars truly are the great Lion Kings of the past looking down.
Yes, we've discovered that in it's official now.
Wow, I really would have thought I'd hear that reported more in the media.
Yeah, well, we tried. We put out this long film about it. It was animated. People thought it was fictional.
Oh, shame. These things backfire. And my personal favourite, getting to sit down with Amy Orr Ewing and have a proper chat about Dorothy L. Sayers, who was a fabulous writer and led a fascinating life.
In her 20s, she had an illegitimate child that she kept secret. Her parents never knew. There's only one person other than her son that knew about the existence of this child. So she did all of this extraordinary work of public communication and writing in the context of this dark secret, which obviously in the 1940s and 50s was a way more extreme secret to carry than it would be today. So there's an interesting kind of psychological dimension to her work as well.
If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, please don't forget to leave us a rating or review. It helps people find our show.
And we'll be posting a video of Jeffrey Liu's beatboxing spectacular on our Facebook page. It's awesome.
So join us next year for more conversations on life and faith. We'll see you then.